Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
Hallo, herzlich willkommen. Das ist die erste Hörsaalausgabe im Jahr 2017 mit Katja Weber. Herzlich willkommen und Prost Neuer. Ich hoffe, ihr seid gut rübergekommen. Das gesamte Jahr liegt vor uns, 364 Tage noch. Ein guter Zeitpunkt also, um über Zeit nachzudenken. Vor Silvester, in dieser merkwürdigen Zeit zwischen den Jahren, da krümmt und verkürzt sie sich. Und heute wiederum scheint sie sich vor uns auszudehnen und auszustrecken. Über Zeit nachdenken, das macht auch das Superhirn, das heute eine geballte Ladung Wissen im Hörsaal mit uns teilen wird.
Our idea of space-time has got to break down. So this is the slogan. It's always good to have slogans.
Space, the final frontier.
Physics has changed a lot in 400 years, but it's always been about describing how things change in space as they move through time. If you throw yourself into a black hole, there's no real center to the black hole. It isn't some terrible place where you get sucked towards. So that's the typical thing. You go from thinking it's easy to thinking that it's impossible. You can't be a little bit non-deterministic. It's like being a little bit pregnant. So what can we talk about? Not many things.
Naja, das ist wohl ein klitzekleines bisschen kokett von Professor Nima Arkani Hamed. Er hat sogar eine ganze Menge zu erzählen. Von schwarzen Löchern, vom Teilchenbeschleuniger in Genf und vom Ende der Raumzeit. Dieser Mann spricht selbst schon fast in Lichtgeschwindigkeit, um all seine Ideen, Theorien und Erkenntnisse in einem Vortrag unterzubringen. Zu fragen, was die Welt im Innersten zusammenhält, das wurde dem Spitzenforscher buchstäblich schon in die Wiege gelegt. Nima Arkani Hamed ist in Texas als Sohn eines iranischen Paares zur Welt gekommen. Beide Eltern waren Physiker. Seine Kindheit verbrachte Nima im Iran. Nach der Islamischen Revolution 1979 floh die Familie und ging nach Kanada. Heute hat er die kanadische und die US-amerikanische Staatsbürgerschaft inne. Die Stationen seiner akademischen Karriere klingen ziemlich erlesen. Berkeley, Stanford, Harvard. Seit 2008 lehrt er am Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton. Die Kollegen schrecken nicht davor zurück, ihn als Genie zu bezeichnen. Arkani Hamed beschäftigt sich mit theoretischer Physik. Die Theorien zur Raumzeit und zur Quantenmechanik sind grundlegend für seine Disziplin. Aber es gibt Hinweise darauf, dass ein neues Erklärungsgerüst gefunden werden muss, und Arkani Hamed arbeitet genau daran. In seinem Vortrag legt er dar, wo und wieso die bisherigen Erklärungsmodelle an ihre Grenzen stoßen. Er spricht in einer bemerkenswerten Mischung aus allgemeinverständlicher Umgangssprache und physikalischem Fachsprech. Der Vortrag wendet sich ganz klar an ein physikalisch vorbelastetes Publikum. Arkani Hamed liebt es, sich an vorgegebenen Gesetzmäßigkeiten abzuarbeiten. Ich habe es nicht exakt ausgezählt, meine aber sagen zu können, dass das hier seine Lieblingsvokabel ist.
But.
Aber selbst dieses Wörtchen des Einwands schleudert er so schnell in den Raum, dass es schwierig rauszuschneiden war für mich aus seinem Vortrag. Der Widerspruch, das Hindernis, das scheint den Physiker anzuspornen. Ein Journalist hat mal geschrieben, dass Arkani Hamed während eines Interviews 6 Tassen Espresso getrunken habe. Ich weiß nicht, wie viele es vor seinem Vortrag an der Humboldt-Universität zu Berlin waren, aber als er am 30. August 2016 dort seinen Vortrag über Physics and Mathematics for the End of Space-Time gehalten hat, da hatte er schon ein paar PS drauf. Der Vortrag mag schwierige, mag komplexe Sachverhalte und Ideen verhandeln, aber er ist alles andere als verschnarcht. Aber hört selbst.
Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
So we're in a very interesting position today in fundamental physics. On the one hand, we are coming off spectacular successes in the 20th century. These successes were spurred by the two big revolutions that started the 20th century in our understanding of fundamental physics, the ideas of space-time that Einstein gave us, and of even more radical ideas of quantum mechanics. And those ideas were set by the 1930s, and really much of the second half of the 20th century was spent figuring out how to talk about laws of nature that are compatible with these two grand principles. There is a basic theoretical framework that allows us to combine these two principles with each other. The unification of quantum mechanics and space-time is a broad theoretical structure known as quantum field theory. So if you imagine all possible universes that are compatible with the basic principles of relativity and quantum mechanics, there's a very constrained and rigid set of rules for what possible universes could look like. That's this general setup of quantum field theory. And very importantly, a very specific quantum field theory was discovered. It's called the Standard Model of Particle Physics, which describes everything we know about the elementary particles and interactions down to the tiniest distances that we've probed at very high energy experiments, like the Large Hadron Collider, around 1,000 times smaller than even the nucleus of the atom, up to the largest distances that we've probed out to around the size of the observable universe. So we have this spectacular theoretical structure and a specific theory which describes everything we know. Nothing contradicts it that we've seen so far, on the one hand. On the other hand, there are really storm clouds on the horizon that suggest that there's something fundamentally wrong with at least one, likely both, of these ideas. The central challenge in the 21st century is going to be to figure out how to go beyond them. And I think it's starting to become clear that going beyond them is going to require fundamentally new physical ideas and fundamentally new mathematical ideas, and the combination of these two working together in a fascinating way. In a way that's not completely new. Physics and mathematics have had this close connection off and on for centuries, but there are aspects of the story that are quite new and exciting now, and also topical and related to the kinds of things that are going on that are friends like Matthias and Jan have done so much to tell us about. So I want to tell you a little bit about this subject. What are these storm clouds? Well, the first one is an indication that because of the existence of both gravity and quantum mechanics, our idea of space-time has got to break down. So this is the slogan. It's always good to have slogans. Space-time is doomed. It's not my slogan. Many other people have said it before. So let me tell you why space-time is doomed. So we're going to do a little thought experiment. You're going to have to forgive my terrible art. So this is, I'm a terrible artist. This is supposed to be a magnifying glass, okay? So what I'm doing with this magnifying glass is I want to resolve. I want to see what's going on in some small region of space and time. And because of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, in order to probe shorter and shorter distances, we need higher and higher energies. Okay? That's why we need to build a giant particle accelerators like the Large Hadron Collider. Ironically, these are the biggest machines that humans have ever built in order to probe the tiniest distances that we've ever seen. And it's exactly because of Heisenberg. It's because in order to probe higher energies, in order to probe shorter distances, we need higher and higher energies. Okay, very good. Now, in a world without gravity, so long as you can get enough money from big enough multinational governments to build larger and larger accelerators, there's nothing wrong. You can go to arbitrarily high energies and probe arbitrarily small distances and times. But something new happens in a world with gravity. At some point, you have to put so much energy into such a tiny region of space that, remember, E equals mc squared, so the energy that you're putting in there gravitates, and you put so much energy into such a small region of space, so much mass into such a tiny region of space, that you collapse that region into a black hole. And what happens? No information from the inside of the black hole can make it out. So you were trying to figure out what's going on in a tiny region of space and time, and the very act of trying to see what's going on there produced a black hole instead, making it impossible to see what's going on at very small distances. Now, what if you get frustrated by this and you want to build an even higher energy accelerator or a more powerful magnet? What happens? You make an even bigger black hole, okay? And it's even harder to see what's going on at very high energies. When does this happen? This happens at really tiny distances, around 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. That is maybe 10 to the 16 times smaller in distance than the distances that we're probing even at the Large Hadron Collider. Okay? So the tininess of this length scale is a reflection of how weak gravity is compared to everything else. Nonetheless, this is a thought experiment we can do, and it tells us there's no way we can give operational meaning to distances and times that get comparable to these minuscule scales, around 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, 10 to the minus 43 seconds. There's no experiment you can even imagine that can measure what's going on at those scales. Every time this has happened to us in physics before, where there was a concept that we can't even in principle give operational meaning to, it has meant that that concept isn't really there. It's not fundamental. It's approximate. It's approximating something else. But in this case, what's startling is that what we're approximating is space-time itself, and we have to replace it with other things. That's a tall order. Physics has changed a lot in 400 years, but it's always been about describing how things change in space as they move through time, and those are exactly the notions that we have to remove and replace with something else. Now, one aspect of this problem is that our theories just break down in situations where, again, we can extrapolate the known laws and then eventually something goes wrong. So if we extrapolate the universe back to very early times, at some point the curvatures become so large, things get hotter and hotter, denser and denser, and at some point the curvatures become so large that they approach this Planck scale. That's what we sometimes refer to as the Big Bang singularity, and we don't know what's going on there. Very often people ask, what happened before the Big Bang? Well, we don't even know if that question makes sense, because very likely the notion of time itself is breaking down as we approach the Big Bang, and so that's the problem. We just don't know what happens there. We can extrapolate back, and we just don't know. Something very analogous happens if you throw yourself inside a black hole. If you throw yourself into a black hole, there's no real center to the black hole. It isn't some terrible place where you get sucked towards. In fact, it's a moment of time inside. It's like being on the inside of a collapsing universe, and you inevitably get sucked towards a place where you encounter a big crunch. It's kind of the opposite of what happens in the beginning of the universe. Again, we don't know what happens there. It's an experiment you could in principle do, or you could force on an enemy of yours to throw them into a black hole. They would do the experiment, but we don't know what the answer is. Okay? So our theories just break down in situations that we can easily imagine. That problem might make you think that all these issues with the breakdown of space-time are localized to very, very small scales. It might make you think something very naive, like, you know, the surface of this table looks smooth, but we know when we go to very small distances that it's made out of atoms and molecules. So you might think that something that's going on is like having atoms of space and time, that if we go to really, really tiny distances, we'll see that it's grainy and it's made out of it's like a crystal or something like that. Now that actually idea turns out to essentially be impossible to make work. We can't have something as naive as little atoms of a space-time. There are many reasons for this. One of them is Einstein's relativity, which tells us that whether something is big or small will depend on how fast you're moving relative to it. And it's very hard to imagine that these atoms will look small to every possible observer. That's a really fundamental difficulty with this idea of atoms of space-time. But there's actually something even deeper, and I want to spend some time talking about this. It's very simple, but it's deep and conceptually very important. So if there's a few things you might take away from this talk, this might be one of them, just so you see what essentially fundamental foundational issues we're forced into when we think about these questions. The laws of quantum mechanics, so I told you it's quantum mechanics and gravity that make space-time impossible, and now I'm going to give you a deeper aspect of the problem. The laws of quantum mechanics tell us that we can't predict the future. Things are fundamentally probabilistic, okay? And that means that if we want to talk about any precise observable, anything that we can in principle measure to arbitrary accuracy, we have to do the experiment over and over and over again, okay? So because we're going to measure a probability in the end. So in order to talk about something precise in quantum mechanics, we need an infinity. We need to do an experiment infinitely often, in principle. We also need to do the experiment with an arbitrarily large measuring apparatus. And in order to explain why, let's say I want to measure some property, like the magnetic strength of the electron. That's a famous quantity in physics. And let's say I want to measure it. I'm really crazy. I want to measure it to an accuracy. We've measured it in the lab to 12 decimal places. I want to measure it to an accuracy 10 to the power of 10 to the 40. Get that. 10 to the power of 10 to the 40 decimal places. That's what I want to do. Okay? I'm crazy. So what do? I get graduate students food, you know, they come in, I get big labs, I do all sorts of stuff, and it's pointless. Because you see, I'm made out of around 10 to the 30 things, okay? That's just a number of atoms I'm made of. And that means that I, myself, can encounter a huge quantum mechanical fluctuation that would turn me into a cloud of dust. Okay? Or one of the milder things it could do is when I got to the 10 to the 10 to the 30th decimal place, I was supposed to write down 7, but I wrote down, because my brain fluctuated quantum mechanically, I wrote down 3 instead. Okay? It's impossible. It's impossible for any finite system to make arbitrarily precise observations of anything. Now, the degree of the imprecision is really small, of course. It's not practically relevant. But in physics, it's very important to ascertain what the questions are that have perfectly precise answers, because it's those questions that likely belong to the correct physical theory. Okay? We know, for example, that when I just walk around, I can talk about where a ball is and how fast it's moving at the same time. And practically speaking, I can. But according to Heisenberg, precisely I cannot. And knowing that I precisely cannot was crucial in order to make this revolution from classical to quantum. Similarly here, we see that no finite system at all can make arbitrarily precise measurements. Now that's fine. In a world without gravity, we just make the system bigger and bigger and bigger. We get more and more digits, and everything is precise. But in a world with gravity, we have another problem. Let's say I'm trying to make that measurement to very high accuracy in this fixed size room. Then at some point, I have to make the apparatus bigger and bigger. But as it becomes bigger and bigger, it gets heavier and heavier. And before it becomes infinitely large, it collapses the whole room into a black hole. And then I can't do the experiment over and over again because I get sucked into the middle where I'm killed, right? So you see, it's impossible, even in principle. There's no measurement you can make in a fixed size room, no measurement you can make that can return an arbitrarily precise answer to any physical question. This is a very deep fact. Quantum mechanics forces you to imagine dragging around an infinitely large measuring apparatus with you everywhere you go, and it asks you to divide the world into two pieces, an infinite part that does the measuring and the finite part that's being looked at. But gravity is universal. Gravity talks to everybody, and gravity does not like this artificial separation of the world into two parts. And this is the price that we have to pay for it, that in a fixed size room, there is no measurement we can do that even in principle is arbitrarily precise. Okay, so technically, in the jargon, we say there's no local observables. That's just a fancy way of saying what I just told you. So what can we talk about? Not many things. The only things that we can talk about in principle with perfect precision are experiments like this. Experiments where you throw in some particles from very far away, okay? And the apparatuses that throw them in are huge. You can make them as big as you want. You throw them in, they go into the middle of the space-time, they bang into each other, and they go back out, and they're measured by infinitely large measuring apparatuses, again, far away. Because the experiment is done infinitely far away in the past and in the future, you can make them with big measuring apparatuses as big as you want. And the answer to these questions, what happens when you bang particles into each other, they come in and they go out, are the only kinds of things that we can talk about meaningfully when we have quantum mechanics and gravity. Now, this is very interesting. So I've given you a very highfalutin, very fancy argument why you should care about processes where you bang particles into each other from far away and have them go back out far away. There's a more practical reason, that's a deep conceptual reason that we care about them. The more practical reason we care about them as particle physicists is that those are exactly the experiments we do in particle physics, okay? When we collide particles at the Large Hadron Collider, that's what we're doing. We have two protons. This is, of course, this is a very big exaggeration. This is a picture of an aerial view outside Lake Geneva. Of course, you don't see this red oval on the ground, okay? But 100 meters beneath that oval is where the Large Hadron Collider is. You accelerate particles to 0.9999999 times the speed of light, one way, the other way around the ring, and they smash into each other. Of course, the protons are much smaller than that, and the collision byproducts are not as big as Mont Blanc. But anyway, now let me go back and so I told you the sort of deepest aspect of the problem is that not only when we try to go to very short distances, the notion of space-time breaks down. In a more profound sense, there is no space-time at all because there's no measurement we can do. It's not like the surface of the table that turns into atoms and molecules. There's nothing we can really meaningfully talk about in the interior of the space and time. Only things, experiments that start and end at infinity are the things that we're allowed to do. So there's many aspects of this basic challenge of putting together quantum mechanics and gravity, but I want to give you one of them, a very early one. It's not one of the most profound ones, as it turns out, but it is an important one. Anyone who tells you they have a theory that puts together quantum mechanics and gravity had better be able to answer this question, okay? So here's the question. And there are going to be a few formulas on the next slide. You don't need to really understand them. I'm just writing them down so you see how concrete these things are. Okay? So one challenge is when we take two particles, like two gravitons, that's the force that mediates gravity. If I take two gravitons and I scatter them, when they go to higher and higher energies, it's again this problem that eventually space-time starts breaking down when you go to really high energies. So one aspect of the problem is if I ask for what is the probability if two gravitons come in like this, and then they scatter at 30 degrees. What's the probability that they come out at 30 degrees or 70 degrees or something else? Okay? In order to find the answer to that, we have to calculate something called the probability amplitude. We end up squaring it to get the actual probability. But anyway, there's a concrete formula for this. I've written it down. You don't need to know what this is. This is Newton's constant, G Newton, just to make it clear it has something to do with gravity. But this has the feature that this amplitude just grows and grows and grows as you go to higher and higher energies. okay? And that means that when the energies are very small, these variables S, T, and U are, have the units of the square of an energy. When these energies are very small compared to that huge energy scale we need to probe those Planckian distances, this amplitude is tiny. That's because gravity is incredibly weak. But if we extrapolate to very high energies, the amplitude becomes 1 or even bigger than 1. And that's a disaster because I have to square it, and all the probabilities have got to add up to 1. It doesn't make any sense if the amplitude is bigger than 1. Okay, so this is a formula that simply must be wrong. Okay, we can calculate from standard physics. This is what we get, a very simple looking formula, but it's simply wrong when we go to very high energies. Okay, so that's the first challenge. If someone comes along and tells you they have a fantastic theory of quantum gravity, they had better be able to give you a formula that works. Here's something you can do. I'm going through this just to illustrate what the typical day in the life of a theoretical physicist looks like and the tremendous constraints that we're under in order to try to make progress on the big questions on the table. So here's the typical lifestyle of thinking in a theoretical physics. Say I have a problem. I have this formula. This formula is fine when the energies are low. It's terrible when the energies are high. So let's modify it. I'm going to make a guess. I'm going to make a guess for what the physics really is, and I'm going to modify it. And here's a very simple guess you can do. You can get this thing that you had before, and I'm just going to multiply by factors that look like this. You don't need to look at it again in detail. All you need to see is when these variables S, T, and U become really, really big, these start becoming small. And so they make things smaller than they were before. Okay, so that seems like something that you could do that would match the right answer at very low energies, but would fix it, would solve the problem as you go to very high energies. Why not? So you say, okay, that was my idea, and then someone else comes along and says, no, I don't like it. I'm going to square that one. I'm going to write down other factors. There's some crazy factor upstairs and downstairs. There seems to be a million different things that you could do. And again, so at first you think this problem is easy. In fact, it's too easy. There's millions of ways of doing it. And in fact, if all of them were compatible with the principles that we knew, then we'd be sort of in trouble because there'd be no way of deciding which one is right or wrong until you did experiments at the very, very high energy scales where these effects became important. However, you then look at it some more, and there are some very simple rules that you have to check. In fact, if you're a bright high school student, I could explain these rules to you. They're very simple to explain, but there are some things that you have to check whether this, in fact, is compatible with the principles of quantum mechanics. For example, if you have an amplitude like this, right in the neighborhood of where this denominator becomes zero, this amplitude is becoming large, just like a resonance phenomenon when you pump a swing. It's a resonance phenomenon, and it has to be interpreted, that resonance phenomenon has to be able to be consistently interpreted as producing a new particle, which then travels some distance and decays back to the particles that went in to the scattering process to begin with. It turns out that if you just check whether that's consistent, this formula is not. It violates the idea that there's a positive probability for producing new particles. In fact, this formula secretly has negative probabilities in it, which is nonsense. So you think, okay, maybe that one didn't work. You try another one. You quickly show all of them don't work. Anything you do where you have a finite number of these factors downstairs, upstairs, none of them work. So that's the typical thing. You go from thinking it's easy to thinking that it's impossible. Okay, and then this happens. Then someone writes down this formula. Now, you don't need to know what these things really are. I mean, if you know, good for you. These gammas here are a function which is like the factorial that maybe you learned about in high school, except it's a version of factorial that makes sense even when the numbers involved aren't integers. But I'm just writing it down just so you see. It's a very simple formula. And people checked, and this was roughly around 50 years ago, people checked that with this formula, miraculously, all those probabilities were positive. None of them were negative. So you went from thinking it's impossible to thinking that now you found an example, sort of miraculously. Now you think, now I know the trick. Surely there's a million other things I could do. Nope. Once again, nothing in this neighborhood works again. Okay? So somehow there's a singular thing that comes out of the blue that works miraculously. See, it did something. It's not, it accomplished something that the things before it did not do. Now, of course, physicists, we're not religious. We don't believe in miracles forever. You see miracles, and you're not content. You try to understand where the miracles are coming from. And after a few years, people realize that where this formula comes from is the idea that we don't actually have point particles, but they're little loops of string. Okay? This is almost literally what the birth of string theory was like. And it's a little bit opposite to the story that many of you hear when you hear about string theory on television or something like that, which is one day people imagine that maybe things aren't points but little loops of string, and isn't it elegant and beautiful, and there's violin strings playing and stuff like that, right? Okay, that makes it sound like sort of fashion, like aesthetic sense, prettiness, beauty, elegance, those words. We do use those words in physics, it's true, but they're the stand-in for something else. They don't mean beauty and elegance in the sense of fashion. They mean it in this sense, of something that has real teeth, something that accomplishes something miraculous that nothing else did, something that satisfies a zillion constraints and does something new. And in fact, in the 50 years that people have tried to write down another formula like this, no one has written down another formula that satisfies these rules. If you do tomorrow, you'll be a superstar overnight in theoretical physics. It's not fashion. It's not whether you're in the club or not. It's whether you actually manage to do something compatible with all the old experiments, compatible with the basic principles of relativity and quantum mechanics. Okay, as I said, that's far from the most interesting aspect of the problem. It's the aspect of the problem that first captured the attention of many theoretical physicists in the 1980s. But since then, we've learned many other things. And in fact, one of the most amazing things that we've learned is that string theory is not so different from the rest of the basic rubric of combining relativity and quantum mechanics, space-time and quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, as people thought. In the 1980s, people thought that string theory was a completely radically new thing. And what we discovered in the late 1990s, maybe the most important conceptual breakthrough on the subject in the past two decades, is that, in fact, it's not true. That string theory and quantum field theory are different ways of talking about the same large animal. There's one big set of ideas that allow us to unify quantum mechanics and space-time at the same time. And string theory and particle physics are just two different ways of talking about exactly the same thing. Now, this is the subject of a whole colloquium or a series of lectures all by itself, but let me just put it in the context of the story that I was telling you before. Remember, we learned this basic rule that the observables start and end at infinity. Well, physicists love to put things in boxes in order to be able to study them. Okay? So if you've ever taken a physics class, the professor is always drawing a stupid box, and they always make it look like a cube. They never make it look like an exciting box. Okay? So they're always putting things in boxes. Now, we would like to be able to put gravity in a box in order to study it, but it's hard. It's hard to put gravity in a box here just because everything is quantum mechanically fluctuating. Okay? But people in the late 90s figured out what the box is for gravity. And the box for gravity is something known as anti-de Sitter space. This is a space-time. It's not our space-time, but in many ways it's similar to ours. It's a space-time that's static, but has curvature. Okay? It has a negative curvature. And due to this warping of space-time, it has the funny feature that if you're at a point on the inside, the distance to go out to the walls at infinity, the distance is infinite, but it takes light a finite amount of time to bounce off the walls. So that's the sense in which it really is like being on the inside of a tin can. So if you're on the inside of this tin can, you can now ask the question, where are the observables? What are you allowed to talk about? And by the lessons of the first part of the lecture, what you're allowed to talk about is to go to infinity, ping things on the box, have the waves come in, bang into each other, and go back out again, where they're measured again in the future. And the experiment starts and ends on the walls of the box. Now, the amazing realization in the late 1990s is that there's a way of describing, in principle, the results of those experiments. Well, you see, the experiments start and end at the walls. They're not done on the inside. So there's a way of describing how to find the outcome of those experiments that only lives on the walls as well. So there's no interior at all. Sometimes this is said to be something like the world is a hologram, that all this interior and the strings and extra dimensions and all the rest of it is actually like a holographic illusion, a way of keeping track of very strongly interacting particles and forces that only live on the boundaries of the box. Again, this is really an amazing correspondence, and explaining it in detail would take a long time. It could be done very nicely in a colloquium dedicated to it all by itself, but that's not my purpose today. Here, I'm just putting it in the context of the general story with that to talk about gravity, we have to do something pretty radical because we have to go out to infinity, and the interior of space and time is something that has to emerge somehow. This is the first example of emergent space-time, where space-time comes out of other ingredients, except it's only the space which is emerging, not the time. And very importantly, the time that runs out along the walls of the box is the same as the time that runs from the past to the future in the interior of the box. So it's the beginning. It's the first smell and hint of what emergent spacetime might look like. But the really hard problems and the deepest problems and the things that get you into the field when you're a kid, like where did the universe come from? Things like that. What happened to the Big Bang? These involve time in an essential way. So in order to attack those questions, that goes beyond what we now understand in this framework. In fact, those are the really big questions. These cosmological ones are the really big questions. As we go back very early in time, the notion of time is breaking down near the Big Bang. As we go very late in time, something else amazing happens. We discovered, experimentally, the biggest discovery of the last 20 years was the realization that our universe is accelerating. It's not just expanding, but it's expanding at an accelerated rate. And this opens up the deepest conundrums and paradoxes that we have in fundamental physics. The reason is, in an accelerating universe, what we see now in the universe is what we're ever going to see. We're not going to see any more of it than we see now. That's because the regions that are sufficiently, things that are sufficiently far away, are being accelerated away from us so that light from them will never make it to us. What we see now is what we're ever going to see. That has a disturbing implication of a fundamental finiteness in the universe. Okay, there's a finite amount of stuff that we can use, a huge amount, but fundamentally finite amount of stuff that we can use to build detectors, to talk about measurements. And remember, that finiteness is the origin of all the evil, right? Because I explained to you that we need to have infinitely large apparatuses and do the experiment infinitely often to talk about anything precise. Here, for the first time, really since the development of quantum mechanics, there is a series of questions about applying quantum mechanics to the entire universe where quantum mechanics says, I don't know what to do. Okay? I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I can't divide the world up into an infinite piece and a finite piece. I'm impotent. I'm lame. I don't know what to do. It's our first indication that we might need to go beyond the framework of quantum mechanics. I'm definitely not saying quantum mechanics is wrong or has to be modified in any stupid way. Absolutely not. But I'm saying for these questions involving applying quantum mechanics to the entire universe, it's possible that we have to extend quantum mechanics. So certainly we need to figure out not just what emergent space is, but emergent space-time, and we need to potentially think of an extension to quantum mechanics itself to attack these questions. I stress again, these questions about trying to understand not just the singularity early in the birth of the universe, but the fate of the very, very late universe, which is accelerating, are probably the deepest, hardest conceptual problems that confront us in physics today. And certainly almost everything in my own tiny way that I've been trying to do over the past decade, and in other people in more grand and successful ways have been trying to do, many, many people are inspired by this problem. It's very hard to approach it directly, but one hopes that by trying to more fully understand what space-time and quantum mechanics really are, we might be able to get a handle on them. So all of these things are hinting at a clear question, and it seems very likely that there is some deeper structure that underlines both space-time and quantum mechanics. If this is true, it's obvious that it has to involve both deep new physical ideas and deep new mathematical ideas. Again, this kind of transition that we're talking about, we're trying to replace space-time with something else. I strongly suspect that along with that, we have to reconceptualize what quantum mechanics is and perhaps extend it. This is not the kind of thing that happens every 10 years or even every century. Okay, this is comparable to the magnitude of the transition that we have to make in going from Newtonian physics to classical physics. And it's obvious that it has to involve both new physical and mathematical ideas. And in the rest of the lecture, and I'll go through it a little bit more quickly, but in the rest of the lecture, I want to give you one angle into this problem. Okay? There are many people approaching it from many, many different points of view, and I'm actually going to talk about one which is something I'm working on myself, and I'm talking about it, A, to illustrate what one of the things that we're actually doing today looks like, and B, to give you a more concrete idea of how we actually can go, at least one way we can go about attacking questions like this. Because it's very important to know what the big questions are when you wake up in the morning, why you're doing what you're doing, but you can't say, today I will figure out emergent space-time. You go to your desk, what do, right? You check email, you know, what do you actually do to work on this problem? You have to have a strategy. You have to have something you actually work on when you get up in the morning. So I want to tell you what that process is like for me. For me, I've taken inspiration from the fact that sometimes the most crucial clues are actually hiding in plain sight as funny features of the existing theoretical framework. Sometimes big developments took big hints from experiment, but sometimes they were sitting there in ancient things that were passed over a lot and people didn't know what to make of them for a long time. So let me give some examples. Einstein is most famously associated with this. The idea of relativity was not Einstein's idea, it was Galileo's idea. Einstein just realized that the Galilean relativity was not compatible with Maxwell's picture of fields and things working locally in physics, that you couldn't have arbitrary action at a distance. He did a very conservative thing of trying to marry the two great successful structures that were known to him in the past. The relativity of Galileo combined with the notion of locality forced him to modify Galilean relativity to Einsteinian relativity. Another famous example involves the transition from classical mechanics to quantum mechanics. Here, as I've said a number of times, it was a much more radical step, but there were clues to the coming of the quantum revolution in funny features of classical physics. One of them is that in the classical Newtonian picture of the world, what Newton gave us, where the particle goes next is determined by where it is now and how fast it's moving. So it's completely deterministic. In order to go somewhere next, Newton's laws, F equals ma, tells you where the particle goes next if you tell it where it is and how fast it's moving. But around 100 years after Newton, classical physicists discovered totally different ways of talking about what classical physics was. So for instance, they discovered that a particle moves from A to B. One way of talking about it is to say that, well, at every point, F equals ma, and it tells it where to go next. It's very deterministic. But there's another way, which is to imagine that the particle sniffs out, it looks at every possible path that could take from A to B, it checks all of them out, and then it chooses one that minimizes a quantity known as the action. It's the average value of the kinetic minus the potential energy along the path. That's very strange. That's a picture of, it turns out to be completely equivalent to Newton's laws. But it's philosophically on a totally different footing, right? It doesn't seem to be deterministic. It looks like the particle is looking every way it could go from A to B and then choosing one by some rule. But it seems to be thinking about what comes next in order to make its choice. Now, people also realize something similar for light, that there is the Fermat's principle of least time, that light goes from A to B in a way that minimizes the time, and this could beautifully explain the usual things that you've learned in high school about reflection and refraction from surfaces and so on. But it bothered them. The people who discovered these things, De Maupetit and Euler and Lagrange, it bothered them that this second way of thinking about things existed. Why did it exist when it seems so at odds with the most fundamental aspect of Newton's laws, which are they're deterministic? Today we know the answer. The answer is that nature is not actually deterministic. Okay? Nature is quantum mechanical. And if you imagine going back to 1850 and waking up a theoretical physicist then and telling them, in 1930, Heisenberg and friends will tell you that determinism is gone. Then they would be very disturbed, say, how is this possible? Newton's laws work so perfectly. How could it be possible that it's gone? And they would think and think, and in trying to plan for the revolution that's coming, they might say, look, if it's really not there, there must be some way of talking about physics today, not in 100 years, but physics today, where those notions which aren't really there are not playing a starring role. They'll somehow come out as a consequence, but they won't be the fundamental, they won't be hardwired into the description of the physics. Okay? This second way of talking about things must exist because in order to make the connection to the next description, you can't be a little bit non-deterministic. It's like being a little bit pregnant. It's not possible. Okay? There has to be some second way of talking about classical physics where determinism is not so important, because that's what quantum mechanics has got to land on in the limit where quantum effects become unimportant. So all of that suggests that there should be some way of that one strategy, as I said, there are many, many of them, it's just one angle into this general problem, but one angle into the space-time is doomed, let's extend quantum mechanics general program, is to try to go back to ordinary physics, not speculate. We're not talking about the early universe or the inside of black holes or the late universe. We're going to go back to ordinary, good old-fashioned standard physics that we know works, but we're going to try to reconceptualize it. We're going to try to reformulate it by removing as central starring characters the notions of space-time and quantum mechanics and seeing if we can replace them with other things. Now, these are very, very highbrow, very esoteric philosophical reasons to expect that something like this should happen. Now, let me give you a few more concrete reasons to expect that something like this should happen. And to do it, let's go back to talking about the Large Hadron Collider again. And here's a cartoon for what it is that you have to do. The Large Hadron Collider is supposed to discover new particles, right? That's the big exciting thing that it's supposed to do. So here's a cartoon for what you have to do to discover new particles at the LHC. The rates, there's maybe a billion collisions per second. And if we're lucky, later this year, if we discover supersymmetry in a few years from now, if we're very, very lucky, these super particles will be produced maybe one of them every minute. Okay, so obviously in order to discover something every minute over billions of collisions a second, you have to understand those collisions really, 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 really well in order to be able to subtract all the known stuff and look for the new stuff underneath it. So this is a cartoon for how it's done. If there are any experimental particle physicists in the audience, they would kill me for making it look so easy. It's much more hard than this to even look for this little bump. It's really like a needle in a haystack. This is just to emphasize, we have to understand known physics really well. So here's something we have to do. The proton is a big, messy bag of quarks. It's held together with gluons, and we're colliding these protons together at the LHC. So here's a process that happens hundreds of thousands of times a second. Two of the gluons that hold the quarks together inside the proton, they bang into each other, and four gluons are spat out. Okay, so we need to be able to calculate this in order to make predictions, and then maybe look for the new physics underneath it. So how are we supposed to do that? Well, this is a part of completely standard physics, completely standard quantum field theory. Richard Feynman taught us how to think about it already 60 years ago. So this is naively deep in known territory, deep, deep in known territory. And this is what you have to do. Feynman tells you that you have to draw these little pictures. These are the kind of pictures you have to draw in the lowest order approximation. So these two gluons come in, they bang into each other in many, many different ways. And there are sort of tens of thousands of terms that you get out when you actually compute these things. You open a textbook, you copy out the rules, and you see what the answer is. Okay? If you do that, you get a horrendous mess. You get roughly 100 pages that look like that. That's what you get. That's what Feynman tells you to expect. Right? 100 pages of crap like that. There's no reason this question had to be easy. Right? It looks complicated. Two things come in, first this is that, then this is that, then something else happens, and four things go out. Looks complicated. Not every question in physics is guaranteed to have a simple answer. Part of the chauvinism of fundamental physics is the declaration that we only care about questions that have simple and deep answers. And everything else is some variety of engineering. So this looks like engineering. Yeah, it looks like engineering. It's quantum field theory engineering, but anyway, some guy, poor guy, has got to sit there and do it. You pay him hopefully enough money, and they need to. And by the way, people needed to do these calculations because experimentalists need the answer. It's not an esoteric exercise. This is needed to interpret data from the LHC. Now, almost exactly 30 years ago, some people did this calculation. And physics is a wonderful way of rewarding morally good behavior, because they're suffering doing these calculations. Meanwhile, all these people doing black holes, wow, all this cool stuff. Meanwhile, all these poor engineers doing this very tough, hard calculation. But physics is a way of rewarding morally good behavior because this happened to them. Again, you don't need to know what the symbols mean. These little brackets are roughly square roots of the momenta, the energies and the momenta of the particles. But they discovered that 100 pages of algebra, in some simple cases, in some cases where these gluons, or we can think of them as massless particles in the approximation we're talking about here, they spin, they have sort of an angular momentum, they can spin in the direction of motion or opposite in the direction of motion. That's what these pluses and minuses refer to. But in some cases, these 100 pages of algebra collapse to a single term. One term. Now that's crazy, right? So this can't be happening for accidental reasons. And back then it wasn't obvious that this is a tip of an enormous iceberg, but today we know that it's a tip of a really enormous iceberg. It's clear that Feynman's way of doing physics makes the usual rules of space-time and quantum mechanics manifest. That's its purpose in life, that's why he became famous, because he taught us how to think about these processes in space-time compatible with quantum mechanics. So you want to make those two building blocks foundational principles manifest, you get the hundreds of pages. But the final answer is clearly telling you another story as well. Not saying the Feynman's way is wrong, but it's manifesting something at the cost of hiding something else. And that it's really worth trying to figure out what that thing is that it's hiding, because it's likely to shed deep new light on what space-time and quantum mechanics really are. So you see, this dovetails with all these grand philosophical things I was telling you about. I was telling you that we should try to remove the usual reliance on space-time and quantum mechanics for these grand philosophical reasons. And yet, here we are for very practical reasons. There are direct indications, absolutely direct indications, from the actual calculations that something like that is going on. So in my last few minutes here, I just want to give you some hints for what this iceberg looks like that's connected with this formula. And as I said, it's just one angle into this general problem, but we'll give you some feeling. We won't be able to understand in detail at all, but just give you some feeling about the kinds of new ideas in both physics and mathematics that are involved. What has been emerging in this particular subject over the past 10, 20 years is a really remarkable combination of ingredients from string theory, from the theory of how things that very often condense people doing experiments in the lab think about systems of spins that are interacting with each other just on a line. They're called spin chains. Roger Penrose's old idea of twister theory that was the ugly duckling of theoretical physics for 40 years finally finds an appropriate home in these investigations, as well as new structures in mathematics that are even new to the mathematicians that have been explored by them for their own private reasons just in the past decade or so. All of these things are starting to converge on a new foundation, a new formulation of a completely standard physics, where we begin to see how both space-time and quantum mechanics can emerge from more primitive ingredients. So I just want to give you just a flavor for what the new physical ideas are and what the new what some of the new mathematical ideas are that are associated with this. So let's start with the physical ideas first. And we can go back by saying that if we're imagining these scattering of gluons, we can think about the very, very simplest scattering process of all. I did this complicated one with two in and four out, and that was hundreds of pages. But it turns out, if you look at the very, very simplest one of all, which just involves three particles coming together at one point in space-time, these are the simplest possible interactions you could have, and these turn out to be incredibly simple. Again, ignore what the symbols mean. You're just supposed to notice that they look very, very simple. So the basic interactions are incredibly simple. Where does the complication come from? The complication comes from the fact that what's really going on in the experiment is that some particles come in, they're real particles in the sense that they propagate from infinity. They propagate out to infinity, they propagate to infinity, and they register in detectors like click, 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 click. So they're physical particles. So that's what really comes in and goes out. But when we do the calculations the way Feynman tells us to do, what's going on inside here is kind of a black box. We don't know what happened. Some particles went in, some particles go out. It's Feynman and space-time and quantum mechanics that tell you that what happened is that they go in, and this hits that, and the other thing comes in, and they hit it, and all the story for what happens inside. Okay? But that's all a figment of our imagination as theoretical physicists. We don't actually see any of that. For a good reason, we call these things virtual. And if you know, even at a pop physics level, you hear about virtual particles all the time. They're virtual because they involve finite distance propagation of the particles. And they're kind of a fiction that are needed to manifest the usual rules of space-time and quantum mechanics. These virtual particles are the origin of horrible complexity. And it's interesting they're not really there. Well, we don't see them. All we see in the actual experiments are the real particles. So the physical idea behind some of these developments is to try to eliminate this notion of virtual particle. So how can we do it? Well, people figured out how to do it. I won't have time to explain it, precisely how it works. But here's the idea. We go back to these basic processes, these very basic simple processes. These basic simple processes come in two varieties depending on whether the two gluons that came in had negative helicity and converted to plus helicity for their angular momentum and the direction they're moving in, or the other way around. So there are these two kinds of basic process that we can denote with black and white vertices. And so what you can do is take these basic amplitudes and you can glue them together. What do I mean by glue together? So here I'm saying these guys come and they produce these real particles. They're not virtual. These real particles go over there. They meet the real particles produced by this guy and that guy and so on. Everything inside here is real. All the particles are physical. They're not virtual. And so you can take the basic rules and glue them together, not as Feynman tells you to do, but making sure that everyone on the inside is real. Well, it turns out if you do that, this little picture represents is what you get from 30 pages of Feynman diagrams for this process with two particles in and three particles out. And the case with two particles in and four particles out, the most general thing that you get is actually the sum of three pictures that look like this instead of 100 pages of Feynman diagrams that look like that. Now, something which is interesting is that these physical-only processes that we can draw with these black and white vertices, these guys cannot be individually interpreted as local in space and time. The reason is that when I have these three particles coming in, they're moving at the speed of light. So these guys come at the speed of light, they move at that at the speed of light. And so when I glue this to something else, the other particle that's hitting it could be hitting it anywhere along this trajectory where it's moving at the speed of light away from the interaction point. So these individual things cannot possibly be interpreted in local terms as particles coming together at a point and then producing something new at a point. However, even though they can't be interpreted in local terms, when we add them up together, we do get something in the end, which represents the standard answer. So instead of having 100 pages, we have the answer in terms of these little pictures, which are physical only, but where piece by piece, they don't care about the underlying space-time description. It also turns out there's a huge array of different ways of expressing the answer in this form. And so you could start to ask, and they satisfy all kinds of miraculous mathematical identities between each other. And so you start to wonder whether this way of representing things is associated with some sort of new world of mathematical objects. So that's the physical idea. And gradually, it started becoming clear that there should be some way of thinking about what these amplitudes are, roughly in the following way, where if you imagine you give me all the data, the gluons coming in, the directions, the energies are coming in, the direction the energies are going out, that you should somehow be able to associate the amplitude for the process in terms of a totally auxiliary space. Using this data, you would build some shape in some abstract space, and some abstract volume of this abstract shape would actually give us the amplitude. And that's something that Matthias also alluded to in the introduction. It is possible, and it's actually even for the leading interactions for gluons at the LHC, it's not just for a vague fantasy theory, for really it's something close to the theory that describes the real world, that we can think of the amplitudes as indeed a volume of some object that we call the amplitudehedron. And there is a particular theory, a toy theory, that many of us spend a lot of time working on, where this has been developed most of all, which is a cousin of the ordinary theory of strong interactions, which has the most amount of its famous symmetry known as supersymmetry. Okay, but I'm not going to say much more about that, but I just wanted to give you the physical ideas, eliminate the notion of virtual particle, and then only talk about things where particles move along light cones, and when you do that, you find this dizzying array of different ways of representing the answer, which are suggestive of some underlying new space, new mathematical structure. Now, that's the physical idea, eliminate virtual particles. Now let's just take a hint at what some of the mathematical ideas are that are involved. And to do this, I want to go back, forget about physics, forget about everything that I told you. We have a scattering process. Some particles go in, some particles go out. That's complicated. It has momenta, energies, spins, all these crap. Get rid of all of it, okay? What's the most primitive kind of scattering process you could imagine? The absolute tiniest, just the labels. You just have the labels on the particle. There's five of them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I'm gonna scatter them by just permuting them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 goes to 3, 5, 2, 1, 4. So this is a very elementary mathematical thing, a permutation. Why on earth does a permutation have anything to do with the scattering process? This just sounds loony, but we can start to see a relation in the following way. If I just denote this permutation graphically, so you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, goes to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I'm just gonna draw, I had 1 to 4, 2 to 3, 3 to 1, 5 to 2, and so on, okay? If I just draw it graphically on a piece of paper, now all of a sudden, this starts looking like a scattering process, right? Because I have the particles coming in, and then 2 hits 3, and then it hits 1, and right? So this is the picture of a scattering process where going up on the board is time, and I have a one-dimensional space here, okay? So it's a picture of particles in one dimension of space that are just banging into each other. You know, they're just bouncing off each other like this, and if I draw time in this direction, the space in that direction will exactly look like that. Now, there's many ways of drawing this picture, and where these crossings happen can look different in different pictures, but it turns out exactly in one dimension of space, it's possible because scattering is so simple, because the particles just exchange momentum. They just bounce off each other. Nothing special, particularly exotic, can happen in along one dimension of space. Then it becomes possible that for very special theories, these are these famous integrable theories that was part of the title of the poster for this series of workshops and talks that have been taking place here. For precisely those theories, it doesn't matter the order in which you draw these pictures. It doesn't matter the way you represent the permutation. They all give you exactly the same answer. So this was an ancient, by now a 30-year-old connection between something as primitive and basic mathematically as a permutation, something fundamentally combinatorial, which gets lifted to physics of the scattering of particles in one dimension of space. Okay? And this is something a huge amount of work has been done on. It's a beautiful area of mathematical physics that continues to be vibrant to this day. However, while this was always very, very impressive, people, you know, much further from the subject always thought, well, all these miracles were very special to one dimension of space. They can't apply to the real world. They can't apply to the real world for two reasons, because we can't have particle creation or destruction in this picture. The particles just come in and they go out. Okay, and associated with that, the elementary interactions in the previous picture were two in and two out, whereas the fundamental interactions that we're talking about involving three things coming together at a point. This beautiful picture didn't seem to be able to apply to the real world. Okay, but again, purely for their own interests, in the early 2000s, mathematicians started developing another way of thinking about permutations, another graphical way of thinking about permutations. Let me explain what it looks like. So let's say I want to do a very simple permutation, like a very elementary one. One goes to three, two goes to one, three goes to two, or the other way around. Okay? Well, this permutation you represent in a different way. You don't draw things going from past to future. You imagine drawing a sort of a big disk, and you draw this picture with a black vertex in the middle, and the rule for how you read off the permutation from the picture is that in order to see where one goes, label one goes, you follow one into the graph, and if you hit a black vertex, you make a right turn. And if you hit a left vertex, you make a left turn. And that's it. So with that, with the rule, this gives you this permutation, this gives you that permutation, but now you can start putting pictures together in different ways. So here's an interesting way of putting things together, which generates this permutation. So just representing permutations is now accomplished by these graphs with black and white vertices. And it turns out that every permutation can be generated in this way. So if you want to do that one, then here's a graph which generates it. And I invite you, you know the rules now. You could be like even in grade 6 or grade 5, and you could play with this. I don't see any grade 5 kids in the audience, okay? But just pick any permutation that you like and just try to build something with black and white that makes it happen. And you'll find, to your amazement, everything can always be made to work. Okay? So every permutation can be represented in this way. So that's the first thing. At a pure combinatorial level, there's a new way of representing permutations with black and white vertices. Then there's a lift of this to one level higher. I don't have really any time to explain this, but there is a generalization of something as basic as the notion of the inside of a triangle or the inside of a tetrahedron. And that can be generalized from living in planes to slightly fancier generalizations of the space of planes known as Grassmannians. Let me just give you a tiny taste of it. If you want to ask for points on the inside of this triangle, all the points on the inside of this triangle can be thought of as a weighted average of the coordinates of the corners of the triangle. So if I give you a bunch of numbers that add up to 1, these coefficients, c1, c2, c3, and I say that they're all positive, so that you imagine they have sort of positive masses, they're positive weights, then any such combination will land you on a point on the inside of a triangle. But there's another way of thinking about that, which is if I think of this, of these as masses, I can of course rescale the masses. The units don't matter. So only the direction in this three-dimensional space, c1, c2, c3, only this direction matters. So what I'm doing in the space of the lines that pass through the origin in this three-dimensional space, I further put the restriction that these coordinates are positive, and that tells me I'm on the inside of a triangle. It turns out that all of this can be generalized. You can imagine instead of talking about lines, you talk about higher dimensional planes in an n-dimensional space. So k-dimensional planes in n dimensions, that's a very basic object that was introduced by the mathematician Grassmann, who was actually a high school math teacher in the mid-1800s. Now further, if you want to generalize this notion of being on the inside of a triangle, if you want to specify what a two-dimensional plane is here, let's say, a two-dimensional plane that lives for fun in four dimensions, Then I can give, here's one four-dimensional vector, here's another four-dimensional vector, and any linear combination of these vectors would give me a point on the plane spanned by them. The analog of saying that all these numbers are positive is just to say that all the determinants of this little 2x2 determinants of this matrix are positive. And you can check that indeed all the little 2x2 determinants of the matrix are positive. So this is going by very fast, but I just want you to see there's very, very basic math involved. We're now talking about matrices, all of whose determinants are positive. Then it turns out, again, purely for their own reasons, now in the mid-2000s, mathematicians started asking this question. You know, how do we build, let's say I want to build a 7x19 matrix, all of whose determinants are positive. Okay, that sounds like tough. You don't want to just make a guess for it. You want to find a rule, a way to construct it, right? What's the underlying structure that lets you build these matrices, all of whose determinants are positive? And what they discovered was the following remarkable thing. That in order to build the most general matrix of this form, you have to start with very simple building blocks. And the minimal building blocks were 1x3 and 2x3 matrices. So here's a 1x3 matrix, all of whose entries are positive. Here's a 2x3 matrix, and you can see that if A and B are positive, all of these little 2x2 determinants are also positive. Starting with these basic building blocks, they discovered a rule for how to glue them together. How to glue them together in such a way that you built bigger matrices that were also positive. And you see, the rules tell you to start with these basic ingredients and build a matrix in the following clever way. And if you just stare at this and check for a little, you see by adding these B plus Ds, B plus D plus Fs, and so on downstairs, if all these variables are positive, all the determinants are positive as well. Again, it's going by very fast, but I want you to see that you're asking a question, nothing to do with scattering, nothing to do with space-time. You're trying to build positive matrices, and you discover that to do it, you have to glue together little black and white vertices. I hope it strikes you that these pictures look exactly the same as a picture of scattering processes that I told you about in the physical part of the talk, right? That we're starting to figure out how to describe scattering processes where all the particles are real, and there turned out to be in one-to-one correspondence precisely with these matrices and these rules for gluing together things to build positive matrices. In fact, I'll vividly remember that when we first talked to one of the mathematicians who's an expert in this subject, we had boiled things down as physicists to just dealing with these matrices. We thought that they would not have any interest in these pictures at all. We spent a delightful morning talking to him, and it was totally clear we're seeing the same object in a different language. And then over lunch, he said, "This is amazing that we're seeing the same thing, but in my way of thinking about things, there's crucial pictures that go along with them." We said, "Really? What do they look like?" And that was the very first one that he drew. Okay, they're exactly the same as the pictures, same black, white, everything exactly the same as we'd been drawing. That was quite exciting. Anyway, so this story continues. So after establishing this connection, as we go further and further, the story has really emerged for what the amplitude really is. It's associated with these objects that are like the generalization of triangles. In fact, you simply generalize not a triangle, but something a little bit more general. Instead of a triangle, a polygon. You generalize a polygon in the same way as we generalize triangle, and that turns out to be the object that's actually associated with the amplitude itself. Okay? Just to give you an example, just see very concretely how physics and mathematics turn out to be related to each other, in this case in a quite surprising way. If you want to calculate, you have two gluons coming in, two gluons going out, and you imagine drawing very complicated virtual processes on the inside. If you're a Feynman, you would draw complicated diagrams with more and more sort of loops inside. There would be sort of three loops in this picture. If you had L loops, you could have a gargantuan number of possible things you could draw. In order to do this physical calculation from this geometric language picture that I was telling you about, this ends up being mapped 100%, one-to-one, to the following problem that I could describe to a kid in high school. Okay? Here's the problem. You have the upper quadrant in a plane, and if you have L loops, we're going to sprinkle in this upper quadrant some red vertices A and some green vertices B, and they just have to satisfy, they have to lie in the upper quadrant. They also have to satisfy that the line from A1 to A2 always points in the opposite direction as the line from B1 to B2, and so on for all possible pairs. Okay, that's it. That's a problem that's trivial to explain. And yet, if you solve that problem, it turns out through this dictionary relating this geometry to amplitudes, the solution to this problem calculates the physical process involving virtual gluons and all the rest of it. And finally, I mentioned there's an approximation of this toy theory. The leading amplitudes in this toy theory are exactly the amplitudes that we measure at the LHC. And again, if we imagine we have the following process involving 8 gluons, 2 gluons in, 8 gluons out, and they have this chain of helicities, then from this picture, what you're supposed to do, you'd give me the momenta, the energy and the momentum of the particle, and I build a following shape. In this case, it's literally this shape. I haven't told you exactly what the momenta are, but it's a shape that looks like this. And you actually calculate the volume of that shape, and the volume of that shape gives you the amplitude for the gluons at the LHC, the leading amplitude for the gluons at the LHC. As I said, this is one thread. There's many, many, many other threads like this. And this is a big part of what a lot of theoretical physicists, quantum field theorists, and string theorists are doing. We're looking at the structure of quantum field theory itself. Going right back to basics, these are structures that for sure describe the real world. And we're unearthing, seeing in them, really hidden patterns and hidden structures, and they're not randomly esoteric hidden patterns and structures. They seem to be hinting at ways of reformulating what that physics is, where the rules of space-time and quantum mechanics are outputs and not inputs. And that's certainly what happens in this toy example. And I'll just end by saying that we thought, maybe 60 years ago, we thought we broadly understood what quantum field theory is. And over the last 20 or 30 years, it's become increasingly clear that what our intellectual ancestors by the 1930s handed us, these rules of quantum field theory, are one angle into a vast subject that we still don't understand very well at all, which means we still don't understand what quantum mechanics and space-time really are. 30 years after that, we got this big kick in the pants of string theory. And as I mentioned, 20 years ago, we've seen that these two subjects, quantum field theory and string theory, are different aspects of exactly the same thing. So there's questions that various theorists have asked for a long time. What is string theory? More recently, even more recently, what is quantum field theory itself? And I suspect that the most likely thing that's going on is that there's something else. There's some other structure we don't understand yet, which morphs into things that we can recognize as particles banging into each other and morph into a description that's appropriately stringy where that's relevant, but that there's really some other deeper principles that are underlying this basic union of space-time and quantum mechanics that we have yet to understand. And that when we understand it, we'll get a powerful clue to how to go beyond. So coming back to the really driving theme, we suspect that we have to lose these ideas of space-time and quantum mechanics eventually, that they're just approximate. Everything that I was telling you in the second part of the lecture, they're not approximate. We're talking about good old-fashioned standard physics in a regime where none of these fancy things involving cosmology and black holes matter. But what we're trying to do is prepare ourselves for losing space-time and maybe extended quantum mechanics by talking about standard physics in a new language where we don't rely on those notions so much. The hope is that if we manage to do that, we will see that space-time and quantum mechanics come together hand in hand, inevitably, and that it'll give us a clue for how to take this very significant step beyond to deal with the deep paradoxes involving the situations where these concepts break down. So I'm going to end with that. I think all of this has been an exhilarating adventure so far. It's been very interesting that both physicists and mathematicians are working shoulder to shoulder together. This is not like one of the cases where mathematicians were 50 years ahead. You know, Riemann had all the mathematics ready for Einstein to use when he invented general relativity. David Hilbert had all the mathematics ready for the quantum physicists to use when they developed quantum mechanics. In the last 30 years, the relationship has sometimes been inverted in the sense that physicists know all mathematical statements that come from their intuition of what quantum field theory is that then mathematicians have to try to prove in much more indirect ways. This subject is somehow different than that. It's a sort of a new kid on the block where both physicists and mathematicians are seeing something that they don't understand, both. And so it's on a much more equal footing. It's been interesting that I've spent a lot of time, had I known I'd spend so much time talking to mathematicians, I would have actually paid more attention in my math classes when I was in school. But as it turns out, they're a tremendous fun group of people to talk to. And it's interesting that in many ways we seem to be seeing similar structures in mysterious ways. But the fact that I've gone over time in this lecture also makes it clear that the grand synthesis is yet to come. If we understood things very well and we had the synthesis, I could explain it in a short and pithy way. The fact that I have to ramble on and on is a good indication that we don't have it yet. But please stay tuned. Very likely one of the younger people who's giving talks at these conferences will make some revolutionary discovery in the next 5, 10, 15 years, and they'll come give you a 45-minute talk about it. All seems so obvious when they're done. All right, thank you very much.
Langer, langer Applaus für Nima Akani Hamed, Professor für Theoretische Physik in Princeton, und seinen Hochgeschwindigkeitsvortrag über Physics and Mathematics for the End of Space-Time. Ich schätze, eure Synapsen quietschen schon. Am 30. August 2016 hielt Akani Hamed diesen Vortrag im Rahmen der Cosmos Summer University an der Humboldt-Universität zu Berlin. Und damit, liebe Hörsaalgemeinde, geht der erste Hörsaal des Jahres 2017 zu Ende. Katja Weber wünscht euch noch alles Gute für die nächsten Tage und Monate im neuen Jahr und euch allen eine gute Zeit, ganz egal auf welcher physikalischen Grundlage.
Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Samstag und Sonntag von 18 bis 19 Uhr. Mehr auf deradiowissen.de.